Well, thank you all very much. It's a great pleasure to be here. And it's been a great pleasure to be part of this series. I've been to all the other three. I've really enjoyed the other poets. And I hope, I think to some degree, having heard the other poets and thought through that experience has to some degree influenced my own selection here. So I hope this is kind of also continuing a conversation that's been going on throughout the series. I will certainly share absolutely the feeling that Rowan Williams alluded to at the first of these series when he said, you cannot stand and even begin to think about reading poetry in this chapel without breathing a word of thanks for George Herbert and without a sense of who Herbert is and how much he means to us. So I'm going to follow Rowan's lead and actually begin my reading, as he began his, with a poem of George Herbert's. In fact, before I come to reading my own poems, which you have in the booklet, I'm going to read three poems first by other poets. Two Trinity poets, but nestling in between two classic Trinity poets, I'm also going to insert a poem by a living Girtonian, not by me, but I think perhaps Girton's currently most distinguished poet, Gwyneth Lewis, a poem that she wrote in response to a Herbert poem. So we're going to have in succession, before I begin, George Herbert, Gwyneth Lewis, and a little bit of Tennyson. I'm going to use Tennyson to help me cope with standing under the shadow of Newton. But let's begin with George Herbert. And since Ninth Muse has been about trying to bring the discourse of faith and that of poetry together, what better way to do it than with a poem called Prayer? A poem which is not so much one poem as the beginning, perhaps, of a dozen poems, a series of wonderful, beautiful, generative images, each of which could be developed into a poem itself. So, Prayer. Prayer, the church's banquet, angel's age, God's breath in man returning to his birth, the soul in paraphrase, heart in pilgrimage, the Christian plummet sounding heaven and earth, engine against the Almighty, sinner's tower, reversed thunder, Christ's side-piercing spear. The 6 days world transposing in an hour, a kind of tune which all things hear and fear. Softness and peace and joy and love and bliss, exalted manner, gladness of the best. Heaven in ordinary, man well dressed, the Milky Way, the bird of paradise, church bells beyond the stars heard, the soul's blood, the land of spices, something understood. There have been many responses to that extraordinary poem over the years. I've written one myself, but I would like to read you, I think, one of the most beautiful transpositions, the 6 days world transposing in an hour, a transposition, as it were, from the 17th century to our own time, perhaps from prayer in a very confessional sense, religion in that sense, into a spirituality and meditation, perhaps more broadly, but a beautiful transposition by Gwyneth Lewis in a poem she wrote called Homecoming. I hope you'll catch some of the resonance between the two poems. So, Homecoming. Two rivers deepening into one. Less said, more meant. A field of corn adjusting to harvest. A battle won by yielding. Days emptied to their brim. An autumn, a wedding, a logarithm, self-evidence earned. A coming home to something brand new and yet always known. Not doing, but being. A single noun. Now in infinity. A fortune found in all that's disposable. not out there, but in. The ceremonials of light in the rain, the power of being nothing but sane. So I'll let those two poems, as it were, speak to one another in your hearts and minds. Now, I think it was Richard Berengarten, who's here tonight, who alluded in his reading to the fact that he was standing somewhat under the shadow of Newton. And I think he both evoked something of what Blake had to say, though he did also, I think, quote Pope's famous praise of Newton. You remember, nature and all her ways lay hid in night. God said, let Newton be, and all was light. Except that for Blake and for some others after him, there was something not quite right. Perhaps an insistence on Newton's system that was more insistent than he himself had been. He was a man, of course, of deep spirituality and great piety. But the kind of recourse to Newton to enforce an entirely mechanized and mechanizing and also a totalizing, a completely, in some senses, arrogant assumption about what we could know was perhaps pushed too far. And so Blake had his objections. Keats was anxious that Newton, in his optics, had unwoven the rainbow. But whenever I come into this antechapel, the sort of hidden thread of conversation that I feel is between this statue and that one over there of Alfred Lord Tennyson. And I want, we've already had a reading from a bit of In Memoriam, that very powerful passage we heard, I guess, a couple of weeks ago. I think it was Richard again, or it might have been. No, it was Clive Willmer read that terrible moment in In Memoriam. So runs my dream, but what am I? An infant crying in the night, an infant crying for the light and with no language but a cry. I want to read to you from the very opening of In Memoriam. It's a passage he actually wrote at the end of the poem and then put at the beginning of it. And perhaps it gives the results, if you like, of some of the struggle and agony he went through. But there's a wonderful phrase about how our systems, however great, are little in the face of the mystery of God. And in particular, he uses the image of broken lights. They are but broken lights of thee. And it was only as I was contemplating what bit of Tennyson to read tonight and thinking about standing here that I wondered whether perhaps broken lights is a gentle allusion to his fellow Trinity member, because, of course, the optics was about breaking light. So these are some verses from the opening of In Memoriam. Strong Son of God, immortal love, whom we that have not seen thy face by faith and faith alone embrace, believing where we cannot prove, thine are these orbs of light and shade. Thou madest life in man and brute, thou madest death, and lo, thy foot is on the skull that thou hast made. Our little systems have their day. They have their day and cease to be. They are but broken lights of thee, and thou, O Lord, art more than they. We have but faith, we cannot know, for knowledge is of things we see, and yet we trust it comes from thee, a beam in darkness, let it grow. Let knowledge grow from more to more, but more of reverence in us dwell, that mind and soul, according well, may make one music as before. And that seems to me to be no bad agenda to set for poetry, that mind and soul might make one music, as well as the agenda very beautifully pursued in this university now. I think Tennyson would be delighted that we have, and he's a colleague of mine, so I'm delighted to have him as a colleague, that we have a university reader in science and religion, and that we have that conversation. So I'll turn to my own poems now. I'm going to read to you partly from my current volume, Sounding the Seasons, a sequence of sonnets going through the Christian year. But also I'm going to read you some poems from a forthcoming volume called The Singing Bowl. And I'm actually going to start with the poem, The Singing Bowl, because in a sense it came to me as a kind of a word from the muse, some advice about what it was I should be about. And I also read it because I realized when I wrote it that, rather like Herbert's poem Prayer, it is as much about prayer as it is about making the song of poetry. So I suppose this is what I'm trying to do. The Singing Bowl. Begin the song exactly where you are. Remain within the world of which you're made. Call nothing common in the earth or air. Accept it all and let it be for good. Start with the very breath you breathe in now, this moment's pulse, this rhythm in your blood, and listen to it ringing soft and low. Stay with the music. Words will come in time. Slow down your breathing. Keep it deep and slow. Become an open singing bowl whose chime is richness rising out of emptiness and timelessness resounding into time. And when the heart is full of quietness, begin the song exactly where you are. The final poem I'll read at the very end of the whole reading also starts with that same line, and it's kind of a resonant thing going through. What I'm going to do now is read you some of the sonnets from my sonnet sequence, Sounding the Seasons, starting with O Sapientia, which is one of my O Advent antiphon sonnets, sonnets written in response to those Advent antiphons. I'm glad, as Richard was, I think it was Richard who said that there's something about the sonnet and the way it works and its particular concentration and connection that makes it quite helpful to see it on the page as you hear it. So I'm grateful to Paul for producing this. In the introduction to Sounding the Seasons, I quote from a wonderful little passage by another contemporary poet, great Scottish poet, Don Paterson, in his introduction to a Faber book, I think, of 101 sonnets, or perhaps a Penguin book of 101 sonnets. He has this to say about the sonnet, particularly as a visual form, which, since we're about to do a sequence of them, I thought I'd read to you. He writes, "As poetry moved slowly off the tongue and onto the page, the visual appeal of an approximately square field of black text on a sheet of white paper must have been impossible to resist." Which is what the sonnet is, first and foremost, a small square poem. It presents both poet and reader with a vivid symmetry that is the perfect emblem of the meaning of a sonnet, a meaning a sonnet seeks to embody. So a sonnet is a paradox, a little squared circle, a mandala that invites our meditation. I think it's just a beautiful account of what a sonnet is. So I'm now going to read you two of the seven antiphon ones. The opening one, O Sapientia, responding to the great prayer, O Wisdom, proceeding from the mouth of the Most High. And the final one, O Emmanuel. If you're not familiar with the Advent antiphons, you may be more familiar than you think, because most of the verses in the Advent hymn, O Come, Emmanuel, are based on the Advent antiphons. O Come, Thou Key of David, O Come, Thou Dayspring, and so on. So I'll read you the first and last of these without interruption. O Sapientia. I cannot think unless I have been thought, nor can I speak unless I have been spoken. I cannot teach except as I am taught, or break the bread except as I am broken. O mind behind the mind through which I seek, O light within the light by which I see, O word beneath the words with which I speak, O founding unfound wisdom finding me, O sounding song whose depth is sounding me, O memory of time reminding me, my ground of being always grounding me, my maker's bounding line defining me, come, hidden wisdom, come with all you bring, come to me now, disguised as everything. And then the final one, O Emmanuel. O come and be our God with us. O long-sought withness for a world without. O secret seed, O hidden spring of light, come to us, wisdom. Come, unspoken name. Come, root and key and king and holy flame. O quickened little wick, so tightly curled, be folded with us into time and place. Unfold for us the mystery of grace and make a womb of all this wounded world. O heart of heaven, beating in the earth, O tiny hope amidst our hopelessness, come to be born, to bear us to our birth, to touch a dying world with new-made hands, and make these rags of time our swaddling bands. The sequence as a whole, the 70 sonnets of Sounding the Seasons, go right through the church year. And in the cycle of the church year, obviously, they tell the great narrative of the Gospels, of, from the Annunciation to the Incarnation, and then so on through to Holy Week and Death and Resurrection. I thought I'd read you the Annunciation poem, partly because another little act of pietas to George Herbert. A vital verse for me, for my whole understanding of everything, the whole world, is encapsulated in those words of George Herbert's, "A man that looks on glass, on it may stay his eye, or if he pleaseth, through it pass, and then the heavens espy." And that question of staying and passing through, and why it's important actually to do both, the bothness of that poem, is important to me. But I suppose I'm particularly interested in, we have a very photo-visual, surface, image-driven culture, so we are perhaps more stayed, not so much voluntarily, but almost stuck and glued onto surfaces now. And so the use of the word stayed at the beginning of this poem is a nod in Herbert's direction. So this is the Annunciation. "We see so little stayed on surfaces, we calculate the outsides of all things. Preoccupied with our own purposes, we miss the shimmer of the angels' wings. They coruscate around us in their joy, a swirl of wheels and eyes and wings unfurled. They guard the good we purpose to destroy, a hidden blaze of glory in God's world. But on this day, a young girl stopped to see with open eyes and heart. She heard the voice, the promise of his glory yet to be, as time stood still for her to make a choice. Gabriel knelt, and not a feather stirred. The Word himself was waiting on her word." I suppose right at the core of the that sequence, Sounding the Seasons, is the Holy Week and Good Friday poetry, and particularly the Stations of the Cross. I had originally just written the Advent antiphons, and I thought that was the end of the story. And then an ordinand from Westcote House, who'd been on assignment to us at St. Edward's, came. She was coming back before she was priested to Westcote, and she came and found me and said, "Well, we've got the Advent one, so when are you going to do the Stations of the Cross?" And so sort of more or less my marching orders. But so I thought, well, I'd try, and then they came, so I did them. And once I had the Advent antiphons and the Stations, I thought, well, I might as well join the dots, you know, and we'll go through the rest of the church year and take a leaf out of John Keble's book. So I'm giving you several of them. I'm mainly concentrating, of course, on the actual crucifixion and the death of Christ. But I'm going to start with the station where Veronica wipes the face of Jesus. The other thing I just say briefly about this as a sonnet sequence, my other great exemplar, apart from George Herbert, in making that book, and John Keble, is John Donne. And in particular, John Donne has a very fine sequence of seven poems called La Corona, seven sonnets, in which the last line of each sonnet is the first line of the following sonnet. So they're linked together. Now, I decided to do, since there are 14 stations of the cross, I decided to do a double corona, but I actually didn't want to do the linking of first and last lines, because I don't think the story of the Passion and the Resurrection is a circular story. I think it's a dramatic turning point in the story of the cosmos. I don't think it's about circling back. I think it's about an entirely new beginning. But I still wanted that sense of link. So in my corona, each sonnet does lend a line to the following sonnet, but it's not necessarily first and last. They come at various points and places. You won't see that so much with the Veronica one, which is out of sequence, but you'll see it in the others as we move forward. And I'll just read them right through. My other, of course, little nod of acknowledgement is I'm very, very drawn to and read a lot of Samuel Beckett. And I suppose, like many people who like Beckett, one of my favorite Beckett lines from The Unnameable is, "I can't go on, I'll go on." Actually, in some ways, I think that was quite helpful to me in understanding both the cross and the experience of depression. Interestingly, just to bring Rowan, who started this series, when I'd finished the sonnets for the Stations of the Cross, because I sometimes... I sent them to Rowan, and he wrote a very kind letter back. And the line that he... this was at the height of all the extraordinary things he was having to do. The line that he singled out, which was great to have a line singled out. Sadly, it was Samuel Beckett's and not mine. But the line he singled out was, "I can't go on," or you can't go on, you go on anyway. And anyway, so I'll redo the sixth station and then a sequence from 9 through to 12. And again, I'll just do those straight through. Veronica wipes the face of Jesus. Bystanders and bypassers turn away and wipe his image from their memory. She keeps her station. She is here to stay and stem the flow. She is the reliquary of his last look on her. The bloody sweat and salt tears of his love are soaking through the folds of her devotion and the wet folds of her handkerchief, like the dew of morning, like a softening rain of grace. Because she wiped the grime from off his skin and glimpsed the Godhead in his human face, whose hidden image we all bear within, through all our veils and shrouds of daily pain, the face of God is shining once again. Jesus falls for the third time. He weeps with you, and with you he will stay when all your staying power has run out. You can't go on. You go on anyway. He stumbles just beside you when the doubt that always haunts you cuts you down at last and takes away the hope that drove you on. This is the third fall, and it hurts the worst, this long descent through darkness to depression, from which there seems no rising and no will to rise or breathe or bear your own heartbeat. Twice you survived, this third will surely kill. And you could almost wish for that defeat, except that in the cold hell where you freeze, you find your God beside you on his knees. Jesus is stripped of his garments. You can't go on, you go on anyway. He goes with you, his cradle to your grave. Now is the time to loosen, cast away the useless weight of everything but love. For he began his letting go before the worlds for which he dies were made, emptied himself, became one of the poor to make you rich in him and unafraid. See? As they strip the robe from off his back, they strip away your own defenses too. Now, you could lose it all and never lack. Now you can see what naked love can do. Let go these bonds beneath whose weight you bow. His stripping strips you both for action now. Jesus is nailed to the cross. See, as they strip the robe from off his back and spread his arms and nail them to the cross, the dark nails pierce him and the sky turns black, and love is firmly fastened onto loss. But here, a pure change happens. On this tree, loss becomes gain. Death opens into birth. Here, wounding heals and fastening makes free. Earth breathes in heaven. Heaven roots in earth. And here we see the length, the breadth, the height, where love and hatred meet and love stays true, where sin meets grace and darkness turns to light. We see what love can bear and be and do. And here our Savior calls us to his side. His love is free. His arms are open wide. And finally, from that sequence, Jesus dies on the cross. The dark nails pierce him and the sky turns black. We watch him as he labors to draw breath. He takes our breath away to give it back, return it to its birth through his slow death. We hear him struggle, breathing through the pain, who once breathed out his spirit on the deep, who formed us when he mixed the dust with rain and drew us into consciousness from sleep. His spirit and his life, he breathes in all, mantles his world in this one atmosphere. And now he comes to breathe beneath the pall of our pollutions, draw our injured air to cleanse it and renew. His final breath breathes and bears us through the gates of death. So, just leaving now that first book, Sounding the Seasons, I thought I'd better finish with, since I'm in Trinity Chapel, I'd better have my Trinity Sunday poem. I know that some of the folk that have bought that book have been hard-pressed clergy who may have suddenly to do an 8 o'clock in the morning service on Trinity Sunday and think, I can't do a full Trinity. Oh, there's a sonnet. That'll just take a minute to read. We'll have that. So if nothing else, I hope it's a service to the hard-pressed clergy. This sonnet, the term coherent in it is drawing particularly on the theology of Charles Williams, a much neglected and brilliant 20th century theologian. But it's kind of riffing on our being made in God's image. Those of you who also know the work of Jeremy Begbie and the wonderful way in which he uses music and particularly the structure of the chord to help us think about God, we'll probably note a couple of Begbieisms in here as well. But there we go. Trinity Sunday. In the beginning, not in time or space, but in the quick before both space and time, in life, in love, in coherent grace, in three in one in three, in rhyme, in music, in the whole creation story, in his own image, his imagination, the triune poet makes us for his glory and makes us each the other's inspiration. He calls us out of darkness, chaos, chance, to improvise a music of our own. To sing the chord that calls us to the dance, three notes resounding from a single tone, to sing the end in whom we all begin, our God, beyond, beside us, and within. So now, in the time that's left of me, Miss One or Two, I want to read some of the poems that will be in the next volume, the Singing Bowl, which are a much wider variety. Sounding the Seasons is very much a single sonnet sequence journeying through the year. This is a much wider variety of kinds of poems and topics and so on, although it does in fact also have a couple of sonnet sequences within it, because as Don Paterson said, it's impossible to resist that little square on the page. Once you've written one, it is a kind of... Also, I found that sonnets are really good for pain control. I broke my ankle, and actually when I first started the sonnets, I'd torn the cartilage in my knee, and the kind of particular fascination and deep concentration that composing a sonnet involves does actually block out pain. It's quite good, and when you run out of codeine and whiskey, you know. So anyway, I'm moving off from sonnets. I'm now going to read you a poem which is written in Spenserian stanzas. It's about walking, something I can't do so well now, but this is when I could do it. It's called Out in the Elements, and it touches on the four elements, the traditional elements of earth, air, water, and fire, though it's also about perhaps what the quintessence, the fifth one, might be. And I included this partly because I'm trying in this poem to go for sound, and I think Tennyson, of all the poets, had, T.S. Eliot said this, had Tennyson had the best ear for the sound of English. But there's a Tennysonian connection here which is quite different. Tennyson was a great smoker. He smoked a pipe regularly and furiously in dark, strong tobaccos and was much rebuked for it by many worthy and respectable people. And when that statue there came to be made and commissioned, there was a secret conspiracy between the person who donated it and the sculptor against the then master of this college, Montague Butler. Montague Butler deeply disapproved of smoking on all its sorts. And they hid in the side of that statue, just among the laurel leaves there, some of which look curiously like tobacco leaves, but among the laurel leaves you will see peeping out the bowl of Tennyson's pipe. It's just there by the book, a little tribute to his smoky muse. And so I always touch that when I come in here, just that's my little touching point. So I have also, not so much concealed, when I come to the element of fire in this poem, I do mention my own smoking habit. So this is called Out in the Elements. I crunch the gravel on my raveled walks and clabber with my boots in the wet clay. For I myself am clay that breathes and talks. Articulated earth, I move and pray, alive at once to walk and be the way. The root beneath, the branch above the tree, these hedges bright with blossom, white with may, everything concentrates, awaits in me the coming of the one who sets creation free. Earth opens now to sudden drumming rains, the raised and falling waters of the sea, whose tidal pull and play is in my veins, spilling and spreading, filling, flowing free, whose ebb and flow is still at work in me, and in the wombing pulse of play and work, when heartbeats pushed in waves of empathy, till waters broke and bore me from the dark, and found this foundered shore and took me from the ark. As rain recedes, I pause to fill my pipe and kindle fire that flickers into light and lights the leaf all curled and cured and ripe within a burr-starred bowl. How fierce and bright it glows against the cold, and I delight in taste and fragrant, watching wisps of grey and graceful smoke in their brief flight as sun breaks from the clouds and lights my way. I feel the fire that makes the light that makes the day. Now air is all astir in breaks and blasts. The last grey rags of cloud are blown aside. The hedgerows hush and rustle in the gusts as clean winds whistle round me. Far and wide, bent grasses and frail flowers lean aside. I breathe the world in with the brimming breeze that tugs at me and eddies at my side, quickens and flickers through the tangled trees and breathes me back to life and brings me to my knees. Akin to every creature, I will learn from each and all the meaning of my birth. I love the dust to which I will return, the subtle substance of my mother earth. from water born, by fire fathered forth, an index and epitome of nature. I sum and summon all the world is worth, and breathing now his elemental air, I find the one within, without, and everywhere. So that was a sort of celebration of the creation in the traditional four elements, but I don't want to be entirely archaizing, so like lots of other people in Cambridge, I avail myself of the Science Week when it comes up, and I go to lots of sparky and interesting science lectures, and I went to one a couple of years ago on string theory, which I have to say, I mean, I'm not sure how far I understood it, but it was wonderful. As I understood it, Parche, our little systems having their day, and Milton, as I understood it, it was a way, almost a metaphorical way, of thinking about the phenomenal world, the experience we have of weight and gravity and dimension and consciousness and the other things we have, that these might be regarded in terms of true source and origin as it were, harmonics struck from tiny, tiny, you know, infinitesimally small strings in 11 dimensions. At least that's as far as I was able to. Anyway, it struck some Pythagorean notes in me, but I also just, I love that idea of the harmonics, and like Paul, like one or two others, it's an immense privilege to be a chaplain or a dean in a Cambridge college, to come Sunday by Sunday and hear a good choir gather and sing antiphonally, to be, as it were, caught up in this conscious and beautiful exchange of harmony, in which past and present are moving together, in which the body becomes spiritual, the spiritual is embodied, something extraordinary is built and sounded invisibly in the air, and you enter into a new kind of space. It is a remarkable thing. So I decided to dedicate this poem about string theory to Girton Choir. And I also, again, George Herbert, the tutelary spirit of this place, he wrote some wonderful shape poems, Easter Wings and others. So this is also my go at a shape poem, so I'm glad you can see it in front of you. String theory. In the beginning, only this, a sound. A sound whose waves expand, whose echoes still expend themselves in rifts of time and space, in overlapping amplitudes of bliss, pattering into patterns, into persons, into us. Conscious harmonics, singing face to face. Resounding into music now, we trace in touches of a single string our source, flowing in everything, for everything in the beginning, in the end, is only this, a sound. And if that was a poem about sort of cosmic beginnings, and I want to write a poem now about, read a poem now about the beginnings of the kind of making and shaping to, with which poets have to do. Richard Berengarten, I think, in the conversation after his reading, there was a question about why one writes poetry, what is it, you know, about making poetry rather than prose, and I think Richard alluded to the whole idea of the word-making things, that there's something incantatory or magical, there's something summoning of experience itself in the way words work. And so that's what this poem, Spell, is about. I'm sure there are many people here who do write and who enjoy writing, and I don't know if you just had that extraordinary sense of almost of giddying and delighted vertigo as you sit in front of an empty page and you think, I could write anything at this point. I can combine the letters of the English language, which I have at my disposal, in infinite ways, and I can summon anything and bring it into being. It's an extraordinary thing to feel you can do. So, this one's called Spell. Summon the summoners, the 26 enchanters, spelling silence into sound. They bind and loose, they find and are not found. Recall the river tongues from Alf to Styx. Summon the summoners, the shaping shapes, the grounds of sound, the generative grammar, signs of the mystery, inscribed arcana, runes from the root tree written in the deeps, leaves from the tail tree lifted swift and free, shining, recombining in their dance, the genesis of every utterance, pattering the pattern of the tree. Summon the summoners and let them sing. The summoners will summon everything. So unless we get too kind of cosmic about poetry there, I feel I could bring us down to earth. And there's nowhere more down to earth than the administrative corridors in any college, where all the clattering of the photocopiers and the general, where actually everything really important happens there. Anyway, I regret to say that once when I was giving, not in Girton and not in this college, but in another place, I was giving a lecture on poetry, and I was too late, you know, and I hadn't done the photocopying, and I hoped there'd be somebody to help me, but there wasn't. And I got there, you know, with only about 2 minutes to go, and with a little bit of poetry, and thought, oh, I've got to photocopy this. And it was one of those huge machines with loads of trays. I didn't know what to do. So I just put a little bit of poetry in at one end and pressed a random button and hoped to get lots of poetry out the other end. And unfortunately, there was this horrible graunching noise, and the entire thing just ground to a halt, and all the red lights came on, and oh, no. And the bell went. So I wrenched as much as I could out of this ruined machine and went off and didn't have the handout and gave my lecture inadequate as I could. And then, of course, because I was struggling with the machine, I'd taken my jacket off, so I couldn't just leave discreetly. I had to sort of sneak back past the office to see if I could get my jacket. And as I was doing it, this hand, this accusing hand, the pointing finger, shot out, and this harsh voice said to me, "Your poetry is jamming my machine." And I thought, that is such a good line. I've got to have that line. So eventually we sorted it out, and I was very apologetic, and the machine was okay and was restored to order. But I felt I owed this person a poem, so I wrote this. So this is a villanelle, and it's Natalie titled, "On Being Told My Poetry Was Found in a Broken Photocopier." My poetry is jamming your machine. It broke the photocopier, I'm to blame, with pictures copied from a world unseen. My poem is in the works, I'm on the scene, we free my verse, and I confess my shame, my poetry is jamming your machine. Though you berate me with what might have been, you stop to read the poem just the same, and pictures copied from a world unseen subvert the icons on your mental screen and open windows with a whispered name. My poetry is jamming your machine, for chosen words can change the things they mean and set the once familiar world aflame with pictures copied from a world unseen. The mental props give way on which you lean. The world you see will never be the same. My poetry is jamming your machine with pictures copied from a world unseen. So I suppose it's a bit of a celebration of what language can do. But I've also, there's a sequence. These are all from a part in the next book, which is called Word and World. And I also wanted to think about the damage language does and the way in which it's deployed rhetorically, particularly in political discourse. I don't know, have you noticed that what used to be called debates or discussions about music are now always referred to as wars? You know, we have culture wars and we have music wars and we have, you know, there's an extraordinary inflation of language going on, and there's something, and of course there's tragic things in America where people have been using the word target about politicians of a different persuasion and encouraging their fans to target those politicians, and then of course the metaphor becomes tragically literal. So this is a poem called What If? And it takes one of the least quoted sayings of Jesus ever and just imagines for a little what it might be like to take that teaching seriously. So Jesus says in Matthew's Gospel, "But I say unto you that every idle word that men shall speak, they shall give account thereof in the day of judgment. For by thy words thou shalt be justified, and by thy words thou shalt be condemned." What if every word we say never ends or fades away, gathers volume, gathers way, drums and dins us with dismay, surges on some dreadful day when we cannot get away, whelms us till we drown? What if not a word is lost? What if every word we cast, cruel, cunning, cold, accursed, every word we cut and paste, echoes to us from the past, fares and finds us first and last, haunts and hunts us down? What if every murmuration, every otioceration, every blogger's obscuration, every tweeted titivation, every oath and imprecation, insidious insinuation, every verbal aberration, unexamined asseveration, idiotic iteration, every facile explanation drags us to the ground? What if each polite evasion, every word of defamation, insults made by implication, querulous prevarication, compromising convocation, propaganda for the nation, false or flattering persuasion, blackmail and manipulation, simulated desperation, grows to such reverberation that it shakes our own foundation, shakes and brings us down? Better that some words be lost, better that they should not last, tongues of fire and violence. Word through whom the world is blessed, word in whom all words are graced, do not bring us to the test, give our clamant voices rest, and the rest is silence. Probably ought to end there, really. But just in case all these poems in so many different modes and forms should make readers of Sounding the Seasons feel that they're bereft of sonnets, I have included... in Sounding the Seasons, the only sonnets for saints are biblical saints. I just stuck strictly within the canon of Scripture for that book. But I decided to range outside it, and I'm doing a sequence in the next book on saints, or not simply saints, but other people, as it were, in the cloud of witness. So I've put three of them in here, one for Hildegard of Bingen, one again for George Herbert, and one for Samuel Taylor Coleridge, who's somebody who's immensely important to me, and my own academic work, such as it is, particularly the book Faith, Hope and Poetry, Theology and the Poetic Imagination, is very much a fresh reading and a development of some Coleridgean ideas about imagination and truth. Hildegard of Bingen, as you know, described herself as a feather on the breath of God, and that's where this sonnet starts. A feather on the breath of God at play, you saw the play of God in all creation. You drew eternal light into each day, and every living breath was inspiration. You made a play with every virtue playing, made music for each sister soul to sing, listened for what each herb and stone was saying, and heard the word of God in everything. Mother from Mother Earth and Magistra, your song revealed God's hidden gift to us, the verdant fire, the holy harbinger, the greening glory of Viriditas. Cherish the earth that keeps us all alive. Either we hear you or we don't survive. And then for George Herbert, I'm glad someone in one of the previous series, I think it might have been Clive, read Herbert's poem, The Flower, where he's talking about the frosts and then the returns and the ups and downs of life. And he says, oh, that I once passed changing were fast in thy paradise. And this poem alludes to that poem. So George Herbert. It gives me great pleasure to read this sonnet in this chapel, I have to say. So it's kind of written for it, really. Gentle exemplar, help us in our trials with all that passed between you and your Lord, that intimate exchange of frowns and smiles which chronicled your love match with the Word. Your manuscript, entrusted to a friend, has been entrusted now to every soul. We make a new beginning in your end and find your broken heart has made us whole. Time has transplanted you, and you take root past changing in the paradise of love. Help me to trace your temple, tune your lute, and listen for an echo from above. Open the window. Let me hear you sing and see the word with you in everything. And Samuel Taylor Coleridge. Coleridge, in a sense, lived the Ancient Mariner after he wrote it. You know, he kind of was alone on a wide, wide sea. He had, you know, utterly extraordinary and transforming experiences and came home at last, as it were, to the land of the Trinity. And curiously enough, his epitaph, which is one of the most abrupt, you know, people, if you go to a churchyard to be quiet and uninterrupted and generally mellow and eat your sandwiches, don't go to where Samuel Taylor Coleridge is buried, because his epitaph says, "Stop, Christian passerby! Stop, child of God!" And it goes on to, you know, to tell you who he is and what's going on. So it struck me that he was trying, being a bit of an ancient mariner, even from the grave. So that's where this poem starts. Stop, Christian passerby. Stop, child of God. You made your epitaph imperative and stopped this wedding guest. But I am glad to stop with you and start again, to live from that pure source, the all-renewing stream whose living power is imagination, and know myself a child of the I Am, open and loving to his whole creation. Your glittering eye taught mine to pierce the veil, to let his light transfigure all my seeing, to serve the shaping spirit whom I feel, and make with him the poem of my being. I follow where you sail towards our haven, your wide wake lit with glimmerings of heaven. Also in the next volume is a sequence of six sestinas, and the sestina is a poem of six verses, each with six lines, as the name suggests. And instead of rhyming it, it takes the end line, the end words of the first verse, and it reiterates them in a different order as the end words of all the other verses. So actually, it's a slightly kind of OCD form, really, in a way. But it's actually very good if you want to write about circularity, about trappedness, about compulsion. It's a form in which to do that. And I wrote a pretty dark set of five of these, and then a final one in which I tried to redeem that circularity and repetition by having a final one about somebody who prays the daily office and is involved in that, which is kind of setting circularity to work for you. But this is, they're also based on the elements. This is the one called Fire, and it's partly based on people I've encountered in Cambridge who've been in the army and who've been really deeply damaged by that and are now not really being looked after by anyone and are homeless. And one of them comes into St. Edward's every so often and sort of goes through the motions of of combat. Fire. He cannot stop these memories of fire crackling and flashing in his head. Not just in fevered dreams. The fires break into the light of day. He burns with shame, and still he screams and shakes because the dead are burning too and screaming out his name. They told him his condition had a name, but words can't quench the memory of fire, nor can they ever resurrect the dead. They told him it was all inside his head, that post-traumatic stress need cause no shame. The army gave him time for a short break, but that's what he's afraid of. He will break, and break forever, lose his life and name, shake like a child who's sickening with shame. He, who had been courageous under fire, who always stemmed the panic, kept his head, and now, all night, he wishes he was dead and cannot die. Instead, he sees the dead in all their last contortions. Bodies break under his wheels. A child's severed head amidst the rubble seems to call his name over the clattering of rifle fire, stuttering guns that shake with him in shame. He's left his family. "Oh, it's a shame," the neighbours said. "That marriage was long dead. You can't live with a man who's shouting fire all night like that." His kids needed a break, and in the end she had to change her name. They'll never fix what's wrong inside his head. Some people seem to cope and get ahead. The army makes them better men. A shame he couldn't cope. Now, he has lost his name and his address. He only knows the dead. He sleeps on benches, but they come and break his sleep. They keep him under constant fire. And come November, when they name the dead, He waits in silence for his heart to break, and every poppy burns with hopeless fire. To conclude, I want to read the final sequence in the next book is actually a sequence in its fullness. It's nine poems about reading Dante's Divine Comedy, the Commedia. I've been so enjoying it. It's another Trinity event, actually. They've been having the Vertical Dante over in the Win Stanley Lecture Theatre all this year, a reading of the Commedia. It's been absolutely wonderful. I was going to read three of these, but I think as time is going, I'm just going to read the final one. You can read the others yourself later, because it'd be nice to have time. So there are three for each of the three cantici, one, three for hell, and three for purgatory, and three for heaven. But perhaps just to lift us after the Sestina, I'll simply read the final one. The poems are about journeying with Dante, but how we journey always where we are in our own journey. So the poem deliberately, as it were, talks about the experience of reading rather than simply retelling the Dante. I also wanted to think a little bit about what it is to read Dante with our own cosmology, with our own sense of how the heavens and the stars work. And I find that's actually quite a fruitful exercise. I try to imagine Dante writing now, and Dante going to Science Week lectures to find out what's going on and finding the poetry in those things. So this is the final one. It's just called The Rose. A white rose opens in a quiet arbor where I sit reading Dante. Paradise unfolding in me opens hour by hour in sunlight and amidst the hum of bees on a late afternoon. I think of how everything flowers. The whole universe itself is still unfolding, even now, sprung from a stem of singularity which petals time and space. I think of how the very elements that let my body be began and will continue in the stars whose light and distance frame our mystery, and how my shadowed heart still loves, still bears with every beat that animates my being, eternal yearnings through the turning years. I turn back to the lines that light my seeing and lift me to the limits of all thought, and long that I might also find that freeing and enabling love, and so be caught and lifted into his renewing heaven. Evening glimmers, and the stars come out. Venus is shining clear. My prayers are woven into a sounding song, a symphony, as all creation gives back what is given in music made to praise the mystery who is both gift and giver. Something stirs a grace in me beyond my memory. I close the book and look up at the stars. I'll stop there. Thank you very much.